Hitler's War by David Irving. One step along a long path. Hitler left Berlin on October 2nd, 1938, with Brauchitsch, Milch, and Tott for a flying tour of the newly regained Sudeten lands. Tumultuous crowds in the ancient marketplaces of Asch and Eger cheered his victory. Quote, "Its scale was brought home to me," he would crow 5 weeks later, "only at the moment I stood for the first time in the midst of the Czech fortress line. It was only then that I realized what it means to have captured a front line of almost 2,000 kilometers of fortifications without having fired a single shot in anger." End quote. Quote, "We would have shed a lot of blood," unquote, he conceded privately to Goebbels. In fact, it had not been a bloodless victory for Hitler. Heinlein's Free Corps had lost 100 men in their 200 commando raids. As Hitler drove on from Asch and Eger, some towns looked as though full-scale war had hit them. Buildings were wrecked, telephone lines were down, there was broken glass everywhere, and there were food lines and mobile kitchens. The armed Free Corps irregulars that they met looked tough, to say the least. Quote, "Not the kind of people to run into on a dark night," end quote, one German officer noted. Hitler's thoughts were never far from the unconquered rump of Czechoslovakia, out of which Chamberlain and Munich had, he considered, temporarily cheated him. Prague had been the seat of the first German university. Bohemia and Moravia were in the First Reich. The ill-fitting frontiers of Central Europe gave Hitler headaches for some weeks. The Poles not only occupied Teissen, but claimed Moravian Ostrau and the important and largely German-speaking towns of Witkowitz and Oderberg as well. Hungary had hedged her bets until too late. When she now bestirred herself and raised demands on Slovakia and the whole of the Carpatho-Ukraine, Hitler refused to listen. His governing ambition that winter was to occupy Bohemia and Moravia. Promoting Slovak independence was one cheap way of bringing about the disintegration of Czechoslovakia. Having decided upon this, Hitler was able to use robust language in rebuffing Hungary's demands on Slovakia. When Koloman Daranyi, the former Hungarian premier, brought a private letter from Horthy appealing for support on October 14th, Hitler would only say, in effect, quote, "I told you so," unquote. Hill's note of the meeting reads, quote, "The Führer recalled how strongly he had warned the Hungarians, both on board ship in August and when Imrédy and Kanya had visited him at the Obersalzberg in September. He had told them specifically that he was planning to settle the Czech problem, so or so, in October. Poland had seen her chance, struck out, and got what she wanted. You can solve such problems by negotiation only if you're determined to fight otherwise." It was only this that gained for him, the Führer, everything that he wanted. Mr. Kania was plagued by misgivings, however, even though the Führer had told him that Britain and France weren't going to fight. End quote. By mid-October, Hitler was telling Daranyi, quote, "The Slovak leaders of every political hue have been besieging us for days, clamoring that they don't want to join Hungary," end quote. This was very true. On September 25th, the Slovak engineer Franz Karmesin, leader of the Carpathian German Party, was to be seen at Goering's forest mansion, Caernhall. Karmesin arranged for the Slovak Deputy Prime Minister, Dr. Ferdinand Dukanski, to see Goering on October 12th. The Prime Minister assured the German Field Marshal that his people never wanted to join Hungary, that only the Slovak Jews opted for Hungary. Quote, "Slovaks want complete autonomy with strong political, economic, and military dependence on Germany," end quote, he said. He assured Goering that Slovakia would deal with the Jewish problem on similar lines to Germany. Goering afterward noted for the record, quote, "Slovak aspirations to autonomy are to be suitably supported. A Czecho without the Slovakia will be thrown even more cruelly onto our mercy. Slovakia will be very important to us as an airfield base for operations to the east," end quote, meaning into Russia. The Czechs too now turned to Hitler for protection. Venice fled to the United States, and moderates replaced his ministers, anxious to curry favor with Hitler. Even so, Hitler dismantled quote-unquote green, only most reluctantly. Keitel's adjutant recorded one telephone call from the Führer's staff thus, quote, Schmunt inquires how soon Green could be ready for launching again. And how long for quote-unquote red, end quote. Red was the build-up against France. The now hyphenated Czechoslovakia was still a matter of military concern. She could still engage up to 25 German divisions. Politically, she was not the threat she had once been, however. On October 12th, the Czech envoy Wojtek Mastny assured Goering privately that his country had done a, quote, complete about-turn, unquote. Czechoslovakia would realign her foreign policy with Germany, follow the Reich's lead on dealing with Jews and communists, and provide industrial support to Germany. Quote, fate and life of Czechy are in Germany's hands, end quote. Goering wrote afterward in a contented diary entry, quote, Mastny pleads that the country not be reduced to penury, end quote. Nonetheless, when the new Czech foreign minister, František Čajkovský, visited Hitler 2 days later, the Führer put on one of his famous acts. The Czech's own notes read, quote, he, that is Hitler, did not conceal that he was not one to be trifled with, and that the final catastrophe would crash down on our state like a clap of thunder if we ever stepped out of line and returned to our old bad ways. 24, 8, snapped his fingers, end quote. Hitler threatened to destroy Czechoslovakia in 24 or even 8 hours and snapped his fingers to illustrate his point. Quote, as for a guarantee, he said the only guarantee worth anything was a guarantee from him, and he was not going to give one to Czechoslovakia so long as he saw no point in it. End quote. Hitler had returned that morning, October 14th, 1938, from a second heavily publicized tour of the West Wall, which had begun on the 9th at Saarbrücken. It was there that he had struck his first blow at the spirit of Munich in a speech to the West Wall workers. He had announced that he did not intend to drop his guard, since in democracies, statesmen who worked sincerely for peace could always be replaced overnight by warmongers. Quote, it only needs Mr. Duff Cooper, or Mr. Eden, or Mr. Churchill to come to power in place of Chamberlain, and you can be quite sure that their aim would be to start a new world war. They make no bones about it. They admit it quite openly. End quote. Coming so soon after Munich, the tone of this speech was a setback for the Chamberlain government in London. Hitler expressed regret to François Poncet a week later, however, that he had ever signed Chamberlain's quote-unquote piece of paper. Dealing with the French, he flattered the ambassador. You could always expect an honest yes or no. Quote, with the English, however, it's different. You give them a paper. There's a storm of debate. Then billions for rearmament, and you're no better off than before. End quote. For some time, he could undertake no further grand adventures anyway. He could not afford to. Despite the economic difficulties, however, he continued the immense new arms effort, suspecting that Britain was merely playing for time. The Forschungsamt wiretap suggested that both Paris and London were trying to sabotage the Munich Agreement. At Munich, Hitler had deduced that Germany would be at war with Britain by 1942. Even before leaving Munich on September 30th, Keitel had telephoned instructions to his chief of arms procurement, Colonel George Thomas, to act on this assumption. Ammunition enough could be manufactured when the time came. What Hitler needed to stockpile now were new tanks, guns, and aircraft. He ordered Goering to launch a, quote, gigantic Wehrmacht rearmament program, unquote. One that would put all its predecessors into the shade. Goering, of course, put his air force first. The Luftwaffe was to be increased fivefold. The Luftwaffe's plan was approved by Goering later that month. It emphasized the role of a four-engined Heinkel 177 heavy bomber. The goal was to provide four wings, Geschwader. Of these, by 1942, a total of some 500 planes. The Navy submitted a more cautious plan. For completing two more battleships, more submarines, and various lesser warships by the end of 1943. Admiral Raeder showed the plan to Hitler on November 1st. Hitler tore it to pieces, scathingly criticizing the puny armament and armor of the two new battleships, Bismarck and Tirpitz, and he lost his temper altogether when Raeder calmly advised him that most of Germany's other warships were wholly unsuited to naval war with Britain. No longer did Hitler fob him off with glib assurances that Britain would not fight. He insisted on the strictest adherence to the naval expansion program laid down, quote, as a matter of extreme urgency, unquote, and warned that he wanted, quote, certain additional ship types of special value and importance for future war operations, unquote, incorporated in the program. The outcome of their meeting was the startling Z plan, under which the Navy would build, by the end of 1943, six battleships of 35,000 tons armed with 420mm guns. The Z plan would inevitably violate the Anglo-German naval agreement, but by the end of 1939, Hitler would long have revoked that quote-unquote piece of paper, arguing that it had turned out to be a very one-sided concession indeed. In the solitude of the Obersalzberg that fall of 1938, Hitler collected his thoughts. By October 17th, he had mentally drafted his next steps. That evening, according to Fritz Todt's papers, he telephoned Todt in the Sudetenland and, quote, clearly specified how much work was to have been done on the West Wall by three target dates, the end of October, December 15th, and March 20th, end quote. François Poncet flew to Berchtesgaden the next day, October 18th, and reached the Berghof at 3 p.m. From there, he was driven up to meet Hitler and Ribbentrop in a small side room of the spectacular mountaintop Kelstein Pavilion. The Führer now startled him by proposing an immediate pact with France. On this occasion, François Poncet felt it all rang true. Quote, he spoke of our quote-unquote white culture as a common and precious asset that had to be defended, reported the Frenchman. He seemed genuinely hurt by the antagonism that persists even after Munich, and in his view, Britain's attitude has made this abundantly clear. It is obvious that he is preoccupied with the possibility of a coming crisis and general war. End quote. The French ambassador probably deduced Hitler's intentions correctly, however, when he reported, quote, we can be sure that despite all this, the Führer is sticking to his intention of driving a wedge between the British and French and stabilizing peace in the West only so as to have a free hand in the East. What plan is he already hatching in his soul? Is it to be Poland or Russia? Or is it the Baltic states at whose cost these plans are to be realized? Does he even know himself? End quote. Hitler resumed his play acting. 2 days later, he set off into the Sudeten territories again. He was to be seen leaving the hotel at Linz with Colonel Schmundt, the latter loudly lamenting that Munich had spoiled their plans for a fight. The whole party descended on a village inn for the luncheon. Hitler, surrounded by 20 people elbow to elbow at the horseshoe table, while the villagers and kitchen staff gaped through the doors and windows. General Lieb jotted in his diary, quote, huge excitement amongst the population. Führer ill-disposed toward the British, end quote. A Lieutenant Colonel Helmut Grosskreuth noted in his report, quote, there was a hail of attacks on the British and French, and above all, the Hungarians, who were dismissed as being cowards and skunks, end quote. Hitler cruelly mimicked the gesticulations of the Hungarian ministers while loudly praising the Poles. Poland, he said, was a great nation, and Joseph Lipski a fine ambassador. At Krumau that day, the roads were lined with delegations from the brewery town of Budweis. It had a large German population, but would be left stranded on the wrong side of the new Czech frontiers. They were waving placards, quote, Budweis wants its Führer, end quote. Hitler, however, had not forgotten them. On October 21st, 1938, the Kelstein Tea Pavilion witnessed a second remarkable scene. Magda Goebbels, the beautiful platinum blonde wife of the propaganda minister, had come to pour her heart out to Hitler about her faithless husband. Joseph Goebbels had captured Berlin from the communists in the 20s. It was he who had created the quote-unquote Führer image and converted the newspaper and film industries into potent instruments of Nazi policy. Hitler had admitted to Otto Wagner and his own secretaries that he was attracted to Magda. According to Otto Meissner's wife, Magda had once told her that her son Helmut was in fact sired by Hitler during a 1934 Baltic vacation. Judging by the pictures, this is improbable. By 1938, however, Goebbels was in disgrace. Himmler had furnished to the Führer a Gestapo dossier of statements by women who claimed to have been sexually coerced by Goebbels. Quote, we used to sound off against Jewish bosses who molested their female employees, protested Himmler. Today it is Dr. Goebbels, end quote. For 2 years, Goebbels had been conducting a secret liaison with a Czech actress, Lida Barova, a female of great bearing and physical allure. All Germany relished the titbits of the affair. In August, Magda had told Hitler that she wanted a divorce, but he refused to hear of such a thing in Nazi Germany's quote-unquote happiest family. He had lectured the unhappy Dr. Goebbels on August 15th and told him never to see the actress again. Quote, it shakes me to the core, unquote, the little doctor entered in his diary. Quote, I am deeply moved by it. The Führer is like a father to me. I am so grateful to him. I take grim decisions, but they are final, end quote. Now, on October 21st, Magda brought her complaints to Hitler again, alone, and demanded permission for a divorce. Up at the Kelstein Pavilion, Hitler persuaded her to refrain from taking action. 2 days later, he invited the Goebbels couple to the same tea house. Martin Bormann embellished the conciliatory visit in his diary with an exclamation mark, and persuaded them to persevere for 3 more months, if only for their children's sake. He would agree to their divorce after that, if they still insisted. Quote, the Führer, the propaganda minister now penned in his diary, detains me for a long time alone. He confides to me his most profound and innermost secrets. He sees a really serious conflict brewing in the none-too-distant future, probably with Britain, which is steadily preparing for it. We shall have to fight back, and thus will be decided the hegemony over Europe. Everything must be geared to that moment, and this must take precedence over all personal hopes and desires. What are we individuals compared with the fate of great states and nations? End quote. Smarting under Hitler's reproaches, Goebbels privately resolved to do something spectacular to regain the Führer's favor. The German army's reactionary behavior before Munich was still a source of bitterness to Hitler. Blomberg had once told him, quote, in the army, obedience stops from generals upward, end quote. That the military hostility should continue even after his bloodless triumph at Munich infuriated Hitler, and he decided to act. In mid-October, Keitel's staff drafted a remarkable document designed to bring the Führer's views to the attention of all officers. Quote, the prerequisite for a state's political and military victory is obedience, loyalty, and trust in its leadership. As every officer knows, any body of soldiers without these qualities is useless. Indifference or a half-hearted obedience are not good enough. They will not fire enthusiasm or inspire sacrifice and the dedication needed to master each successive task. It has always been Germany's lot to fight against unequal odds. Where we have been successful, then abstract forces were at work, acting far more powerfully than any numerical or material superiority over the enemy. It would be a remarkable thing if an officer's only duty were to weigh his own numerical strength against that of the enemy, while ignoring or underrating all those other factors that have always decided between defeat and victory in the past. End quote. In an obvious reference to General Beck's arguments, the document continued, quote, "It is unsoldierly and a symptom of poor military upbringing not to credit one's own side with what one expects from the enemy as a matter of course, or to minimize one's own strength while inflating that of the enemy. To put the military factors in their proper perspective when deciding the political objective is a task for the statesman alone. Were he to wait until his armed forces were completely ready for war, then he would never act because armed forces are never ready, nor are they ever to be considered ready. I well know that in the past months, the broad mass of officers has done its duty in a spirit of defiant belief and determination. But I expect this fact, and its confirmation by our triumph, i.e. at Munich, to be accepted once and for all by my officers, and it is to be adequately emphasized in the training and preparation of new officers." End quote. It was in this prickly mood that Hitler summoned Brauchitsch as commander-in-chief of the army to Berchtesgaden on October 24th. The frosty interview began at 12:30 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Berghof and continued after lunch until 6 up at the Kelstein Tea Pavilion. It culminated in Hitler's demand for the retirement of scores of unreliable senior army officers. The tenor of the interview can be judged from the following entry in the diary of Keitel's adjutant, Wolf Eberhard. Quote, "Führer was brutally frank about his contempt for the military commanders. They need rapid and urgent reorganization, show a complete lack of confidence in the political leadership, and apprehensions about their own weaknesses. Enemy's strength is exaggerated. A last appeal to the commander-in-chief army to get to grips with his job and act without delay. His, quote-unquote, historic mission," end quote. Eberhardt privately commented, quote, "Let's hope that this is the last time that the Führer has to use such language to his own soldiers," end quote. The final list of names was thrashed out between Brauchitsch and Goering on October 28th, and taken by the latter to Hitler 2 days later. Among those blacklisted were these generals: Kurt Liebmann and Wilhelm Adam, Hermann Geyer and Wilhelm Ulichs, and of course Rundstedt and Beck. On November 1st, 1938, Hitler announced this upheaval in the army. He coupled it, perhaps tactlessly, with a wave of promotions in the Luftwaffe. Early in November 1938, Hitler's uncritical loyalty to his party henchmen was put to its most severe test by an incident symptomatic of racial troubles that had been festering in Central Europe for many decades. The Jewish problem was at its root. In Czechoslovakia, for instance, there were 259,000 Jews. They were not popular, and the new regime steered a delicate course, pandering to its powerful neighbor. President Emil Hácha, the venerable lawyer who had succeeded Beneš, initiated a series of anti-Jewish measures, obliging Jewish industrialists to resign. The influx of Jewish refugees from the Sudeten territories led to fresh anti-Semitism, particularly among the Czech academics who publicly demanded the removal of these quote-unquote immigrants. In Bohemia and Moravia, there were about 99,000 Jews. In Slovakia, 87,000. and then the tiny Carpathia-Ukraine, no fewer than 66,000, or 12% of the population. Slovakia eagerly enacted the anti-Jewish decrees that the Reich demanded. A wave of deportations began. Nobody, however, wanted to house these homeless Jews. When Ribbentrop journeyed to Paris with much pomp in December to sign the joint declaration that Hitler had first suggested to François Poncet, Foreign Minister Georges Bonnet begged him not to flood France with German Jews, as they already had enough Jews of their own. Quote, "In fact," Ribbentrop informed Hitler, "they are considering Madagascar for this purpose," end quote. Poland's attitude was no more sympathetic. Ambassador Joseph Lipsky had assured Hitler as recently as October 21st that if he ever succeeded in solving Europe's Jewish problem, Warsaw would happily erect a statue in honor of his achievement. The Polish government had followed developments throughout 1938 most closely, fearing, after Hitler's occupation of Austria, that he would repatriate the thousands of Polish Jews from Vienna in March. They had speedily enacted a law of expatriation designed to deprive such Jews of their native Polish citizenship. The Munich Agreement panicked Warsaw into the further ruling that after October 31st, no expatriate Poles would be allowed back into their country without a special entry visa. The last days of October thus saw frenzied scenes on the frontier. While Polish frontier officials slept, the Nazis quietly shunted unscheduled trains loaded with Jews across the line into Poland. From Hanover alone, 484 Polish Jews were, quote-unquote, repatriated in this demeaning manner. Among them were the parents and sisters of a Jewish youth of 17, then living in Paris, Herschel Grinspan. On November 3rd, as Hitler was subsequently told, Grinspan received a postcard from his sister briefly describing the family's quote-unquote repatriation to Poland. He swore revenge and decided to murder the German ambassador in Paris, Count von Belzec. Belzec being not available on November 7th, Grinspan shot at Counselor Ernst von Rath instead. At first, the incident had not unduly aroused Hitler's temper. He made no mention at all of it in his speeches of the next few days. On the 9th, the march on the Feldherrenhalle was solemnly reenacted in the annual ceremony at noon. Wreaths were laid in the temples of honor where Hitler had decreed that his own body was one day to rest. That evening, he was in his modestly furnished Munich apartment in Prinzregentenstrasse when word arrived that Counselor von Rath had now died of his gunshot injury. According to Goebbels, he told Hitler that there had been anti-Jewish demonstrations in two provinces. His diary records, quote, "The condition of the diplomat Rath shot by the Jew in Paris is still very grave, and the German press opens up with a will," end quote. Then he added that the Jews, quote, "have a few things coming their way," end quote. He received word of demonstrations in Kassel and Dessau and of synagogues being set on fire. At 5 p.m., the official press agency announced that the diplomat Rath had died of his injuries. As Goebbels and Hitler left to attend the Nazi festivities in the Old City Hall, news arrived that the Munich police were cracking down on anti-Jewish demonstrations. Hitler ruled, said Goebbels later, that the party was not to organize any such demonstrations, but under the circumstances it was not to quell them if they should occur spontaneously. We have only Goebbels' word for this, quoted at a subsequent internal party inquiry. In his diary, he wrote, quote, "colossal activity. I brief the Führer on the affair. He decides, allow the demonstrations to continue. Hold back the police. The Jews must be given a taste of the public anger for a change," end quote. Goebbels then left Hitler as he had to speak to an assembly of party notables in Munich's Old City Hall. The minister instructed his listeners, according to one version, that further such demonstrations were to be organized, although the Nazi Party must not appear responsible. In his diary, he proudly recorded his own leading role in what was to prove one of the most shameful episodes of Hitler's rule. Quote, "A few Gau officials get cold feet, but I keep pulling everybody together. We must not allow this cowardly murder to go unpunished. Let things run their course. The Stosstrupp, that is shock troop, Hitler sallies forth at once to deal with Munich, and things happen right away. A synagogue is smashed to smithereens. I try to save it from the flames, but fail." End quote. He continued, quote, "Over to Gau HQ, with Gauleiter Adolf Wagner, I now issue a detailed circular setting out what may be done and what not. Wagner gets cold feet and trembles for his, that is, Munich's, Jewish shops. But I won't be deterred. Meanwhile, the Stosstrupp goes about its business. And with no half measures, I direct Wachter, director of the Propaganda Bureau, in Berlin to see that the synagogue in Fassinenstrasse is smashed." End quote. The responsibilities thus seem clearly defined. A subsequent action report by the leader of the SA group Nordmark would state, quote, "At about 10 p.m. on November 9th, the need for the operation was put to a number of Gauleiters assembled in the Munich Hotel Schottenhamel by an anonymous member of the Nazi Party's Reichsleitung, Reich Directorate. I thereupon volunteered the services of my SA group Nordmark to the Gauleiter of Schleswig-Holstein, Heinrich Lossa. At about 10:30 p.m., he telephoned his chief of staff in Kiel. Quote, "A Jew has fired a shot. A German diplomat is dead. There are wholly superfluous places of congregation in Friedrichstadt, Kiel, and Lübeck, and these people are still trading in shops in our midst. We don't need either the one or the other. There's to be no plundering nor any manhandling. Foreign Jews are not to be molested. If there's any resistance, use your firearms. The whole operation is to be in plain clothes and is to be over by 5 a.m. End quote. Toward midnight, Hitler prepared to leave his apartment for the spectacular SS swearing-in ceremony. Himmler, of course, was with him. Himmler's chief of staff, Karl Wolf, arrived with an indignant message from Heydrich at the Hotel Wir Jahreszeiten. The local Gestapo HQ had just phoned, reporting that Goebbels' district propaganda offices everywhere were whipping up anti-Jewish demonstrations and ordering the police, Himmler's police, not to intervene. Himmler turned to Hitler for guidance. Hitler replied that the Gestapo were to protect Jewish property and lives. It was clear to Himmler that the whole affair had come out of the blue to the Führer. After the midnight ceremony, back at his apartment, Hitler was informed at 1 a.m. by one of his Wehrmacht adjutants that the Hotel Wir Jahreszeiten had now telephoned to ask him to come and retrieve their baggage as the synagogue next door was on fire. Julius Schaub, Hitler's personal aide-de-camp, wrote after the war a graphic account of the ensuing night of horror. But Goebbels' diary describes Schaub as being in top form. Quote, "His old Stosstrupp past comes flooding back. As I drive back to the hotel," continues this entry, "there is the sound of breaking glass. Bravo! Bravo! Like gigantic old kilns, the synagogues are blazing." End quote. Telephone calls began coming from private citizens reporting fresh outbreaks of arson and Jewish businesses being looted all over Munich. Perplexed, Hitler sent for SS Gruppenführer Friedrich Karl von Eberstein, the city's police chief, and ordered him to restore order at once. He telephoned Goebbels and demanded, quote, "What's going on?" unquote. He sent out Schaub and other members of his staff to stop the looting and arson. He ordered special protection for the famous antique dealers, Bernheimers. At 2:56 a.m., a telex was issued by Rudolf Hess's staff as deputy of the Führer and was repeated to all Gauleiters as Party Ordinance No. 174, forbidding the arson. quote, on express orders issued at the highest level of all, there is to be no arson, or the like, whatever, under any circumstances against Jewish businesses, end quote. And there is an asterisk. Some writers now argue that the Nazis had fallen into a Zionist trap. The Haganah officials, with whom Adolf Eichmann negotiated on his trip to Palestine in November 1937, had hinted that it would serve their interests if things were made hot for Germany's Jews to accelerate Jewish emigration to Palestine. It deserves comment that Grinspan, although a destitute youth, was unable to reside in a hotel in 1938 and purchase a handgun for 250 francs, and that his defense counsel, Mauro Giafferi, was the best that money of the International League Against Anti-Semitism, the LICA, could buy. LICA's Paris office was around the corner from Grinspan's hotel. And back up. At 3:45 a.m., the Berlin Gestapo repeated this prohibition. Goebbels, now in no doubt where Hitler's real favor lay, also spent the night on the telephone trying to extinguish the conflagration that his mischievous tongue had ignited. The damage had, however, been done, and Ribbentrop left Hitler in no doubt of this. Hitler responded that he could not get rid of Goebbels now, not when he was about to need him more than ever. He did send for Goebbels the next morning, November 10th, to discuss, quote-unquote, what to do next. The minister used the word Nunmehr, which implied an element of apprehension. Goering protested to Hitler that German insurance firms would have to pay the Jews compensation. The cost in foreign currency would be huge, as the broken plate glass would have to be replaced with imports from Belgium. Hitler refused to discipline Goebbels as the Reichsfuhrer SS demanded. Nor, except in the most savage instances, were the humble party members who had actually committed the outrages brought to book. Although 91 Jews had been murdered that night, Goebbels successfully argued over lunch with Hitler that the pogrom had shown international Jewry that Germans abroad were not fair game for Jewish assassins. Quote, this is one dead man who is costing the Jews dear, end quote. Goebbels gloated in his private diary. Quote, our darling Jews will think twice in future before simply gunning down German diplomats, end quote. There was trenchant criticism of Goebbels' extravaganza from every other leading Nazi, except Hitler himself. Quote, the order was given by the Reich Propagandaleitung, Goebbels. Oh, Goebbels, yeah. End quote, recorded Himmler. Quote, and I suspect that Goebbels, in his craving for power, which I noticed long ago, and also in his empty-headedness, started this action just at a time when the foreign political situation is very grave. When I asked the Führer about it, I had the impression that he did not know anything about these events. End quote. Hitler, post facto, endorsed the excesses of his henchmen. When Goering sent him a sharp letter of protest, Hitler replied that he should drop the matter, but as a sop to him, he appointed the field marshal to coordinate all further moves in the Jewish problem. A collective fine of 1 billion marks was imposed on the Jewish community for the murder. After Hitler returned to Berlin on November 15th, Goebbels smugly entered in his diary, quote, he's in fine fettle, sharply against the Jews, thoroughly endorses my... a Freudian slip, which at once expanded to, and our policies, end quote. Over the next days, Hitler was frequently seen and photographed with Goebbels. In his eyes, Goebbels was one of the unsung heroes of the Munich Agreement. In a long and astoundingly frank secret speech to 400 Nazi editors in Munich on November 10th, he had cynically explained to them just how much he owed to psychological warfare. He spoke of his admiration for Ribbentrop, too. Quote, even Bismarck had to battle against bureaucracy, he said. Today's National Socialist government is still stifled by red tape. It is at its worst in the foreign ministry. Diplomats do not represent their own countries, but an international society clique. this malady in our foreign ministry cannot be rooted out overnight. It will take 10 or 15 years until a new generation of National Socialist-trained diplomats is ready. So far, the first, and indeed the only, diplomat to do the Third Reich proud overseas has been Ribbentrop. He is the ideal image of what I, as Führer, think a diplomat should be. In these last few months, he has shown that he has energy, toughness, courage, and nerve. End quote. Hitler's innermost thoughts still revolved around Bohemia and Moravia. Occasionally, these thoughts bubbled like marsh gas to the surface. Over dinner in Nuremberg on November 14th with a dozen local party officers, the talk turned to the immense Congress Hall being erected nearby. Hitler said that he needed large slabs of granite, and when somebody remarked that the richest quarries were in Rump, Czechoslovakia, Hitler chuckled and commented knowingly, quote-unquote, "one more reason." But over the next move, he differed from Ribbentrop's advisors. Wiesacker counseled the foreign minister early in December 1938 to divert Hitler's attention from the southeast to the northeast. Let the Reich first acquire Memel and Danzig on the Baltic coast and a broad strip of land across the quote-unquote Polish corridor to East Prussia. Poland, argued Wiesacker, enjoyed little or no international sympathy at present. Hitler could shrink Poland to a manageable size, and no other country would lift a finger to assist her. Ribbentrop's reply was noncommittal, as even he did not know Hitler's inner intentions. Not that Hitler was planning to seize Rump, Czechoslovakia by war, as he made plain during yet another tour of the Czech frontier fortifications early in December 1938. After once again lunching in a village inn with 40 Luftwaffe and army generals listening, he loudly discoursed on his intention of bringing Bohemia and Moravia into the Reich, but by political processes short of war. 10 days later, on December 17th, Keitel confirmed Hitler's instructions to the Wehrmacht to prepare unobtrusively for a virtually unopposed occupation of Rump, Czechoslovakia. Hitler was manifestly undecided over what step to take after that. Would he have to deal with the Western powers before marching east? To Goebbels, on October 23rd at the Kelstein Tea Pavilion, and again up there on October 24th to Ribbentrop, Hitler had intimated that war in the West seemed inevitable within 4 or 5 years. Meeting Keitel and Abramovich for secret talks at Goebbels' island villa on Schwanenberger, or November 16th, the chancellery was in the hands of Spears' builders, Hitler conjured further with this probability. His Western plans would depend on signing an alliance with Mussolini. Germany and Italy would then each tackle the Western democracies in a different theater of war, Italy's being the Mediterranean and North Africa. Hitler would tackle France first, he mused. Her defeat would deny to Britain a strategic foothold on the European mainland. Swiss, Belgian, and Dutch neutrality would, he said, be respected. He was unimpressed by France's frontier fortifications. Quote, "It is quite possible to penetrate her Maginot Line," he declared. "We have demonstrated this with our firing trials against the Czech fortifications, which were built in the same way." End quote. Hitler talked vaguely of plans for a cabinet meeting in December, only to abandon the idea. He ordered Goering to convene and speak to the quote-unquote Reich Defense Council instead. Goering did so for 3 hours on November 18th, 1938. Every Reich minister and state secretary was present, as were Brauchitsch, Raeder, Bormann, and Heydrich, too. He announced that Hitler had decided to triple the Reich's armaments, but warned them that due to the events of that summer, the Reich's economy was almost bankrupt. He added, quote, "The Führer's great architectural projects will still be worked on, as they are of moral and psychological value." End quote. The only thing that would tide the Reich budget over this immediate crisis was, ironically, the billion Reichsmark fine levied on the Jewish community, explained Goering. The clock was now ticking ever louder for the Jews. On January 5th, talking with Colonel Joseph Beck, the Polish foreign minister, Hitler rather speciously regretted that the Western powers had not entertained Germany's colonial demands. Quote, if they had, he said, I might have helped solve the Jewish problem by making a territory available in Africa for resettlement of not only the German but the Polish Jews as well. End quote. On the 21st, he uttered to the Czech foreign minister, Tchaikovsky, these ominous words. Quote, the Jews here are being destroyed, werden vernichtet. End quote. The Czech replied sympathetically, and Hitler continued, quote, help can only come from the other countries, like Britain and the United States, who have unlimited areas which they could make available for the Jews. End quote. In a major speech to the Reichstag on January 30th, 1939, Hitler uttered an unmistakable threat. Quote, during my struggle for power, it was primarily the Jewish people who just laughed when they heard me prophesy that one day I would become head of state and thereby assume the leadership of the entire people, and that I would then, among other things, enforce a solution on the Jewish problem. I expect that the howls of laughter that rose from the throats of German Jewry have by now died to a croak. Today I am going to turn prophet yet again. If international finance Jewry inside and outside Europe should succeed once more in plunging our peoples into a world war, then the outcome will not be a Bolshevization of the world and thereby the victory of Jewry, but the destruction of the Jewish race in Europe. End quote. Accelerated by these ugly stimuli, the exodus of Jews from the Reich continued throughout 1939 to stop only in October 1940, by which time Heydrich had successfully evicted about two-thirds of them, about 300,000 from Germany, 130,000 from Austria, and 30,000 from Bohemia, Moravia, and some 70,000 of them reached Palestine, though through the unholy community of Ames that had briefly existed between Heydrich's SD and the Zionists. Hitler avoided the Chancellery area in Berlin for many weeks because it was teeming with Spears' construction workers. He dealt with affairs of state by telephone, usually from the Berghof. He had a constitutional duty to consider appeals for clemency in death sentences and to sign the execution warrants. In bygone times, the condemned criminal had had the traditional right to see the Kaiser's signature on the warrant before being led to the scaffold. In Hitler's era, the usages were less picturesque. A telephone call from Schaub to Lammers in Berlin, quote, the Führer has turned down the appeal for clemency, unquote, and this sufficed to rubber stamp a facsimile of the Führer's signature on the execution warrant. On one occasion, the file laid before Hitler stated simply that the Berlin Chancellery would, quote, take the necessary steps, unquote, if they had heard no decision from him by 10 p.m. that night. Human life was becoming cheaper in Hitler's Germany. The broader economic problems faced Hitler all that winter. A serious inflation had begun in May 1938. Blomberg later stated under interrogation that when he returned from his year's enforced exile in January 1939, he detected a great deterioration in living standards. By the end of 1938, 8,223 million Reichsmarks were in circulation, compared with the 5,278 million in March 1938, and 3,560 million in 1933. On January 7, 1939, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, president of the Reichsbank, and seven fellow directors signed a stern warning to Hitler about the inflationary pressure resulting from recent, quote, foreign operations, unquote. Hitler was shocked by this semi-mutiny. In a secret speech to his colonels in February, he warned, quote, there must be no possibility whatever for anybody even to think that there is some institution or other in Germany that has a different opinion from the one expressed by the Führer, end quote. He already correctly suspected Schacht of maintaining clandestine contacts with foreign governments. And there is an asterisk. Montagu Norman, governor of the Bank of England, 1920 to 1944, told the U.S. ambassador in London that Schacht was his constant informant over 16 years about Germany's precarious financial position. U.S. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy reported this to Washington on February 27, 1939. And going back up. He summoned Schacht to the Chancellery on January 19th and handed him a document announcing his dismissal. The economics minister, Walter Funk, a flabby homosexual, was appointed Schacht's successor. On the same day, Hitler also disposed of his personal adjutant, Fritz Wiedemann, whom he suspected of leaking state secrets. Their final interview was brief and cruelly to the point. Quote, you always wanted to be consul general in San Francisco, Hitler reminded Wiedemann. You've got your wish, end quote. It was at about this time that Keitel sent to Franz Halder, chief of the general staff, a note that the army would have until 1943 to complete its expansion, and that there would be no mobilizations before then. On OKW advice, Hitler decided to halt all army weapons production during 1939 to enable the Luftwaffe and naval construction programs to go ahead. This would bring all three services to the same level by about 1944. On January 17, 1939, Admiral Raeder brought the final draft of the Navy's Z plan to Hitler at the Chancellery. 10 days later, Hitler issued an order assigning to this naval expansion program absolute priority over both other services. He again assured Raeder that he would not be needing the German Navy for several years. What would even the finest weapons avail Germany, however, if the generals were loath to use them? Quote, the brave will fight whatever the odds, Hitler said on January 18th. But give the craven whatever weapons you will, they will always find reason enough to lay them down, end quote. This was the damage Hitler felt that Beck and his general staff had inflicted on the officer corps. Early in 1939, he decided to repair it himself using his greatest gift, his power of oratory. All his generals and advisors admitted that he had this power. He cast the same spell over mass audiences. Whether he spoke from a carefully prepared script, which he had polished and trimmed far into the night, or extempore, timing every gesture and comic pause to ride the mood of his listeners, nobody who attended Hitler's speech to newly commissioned officers in Berlin in February 1942 at the climax of the German army's desperate travails on the frozen Russian front and witnessed the affection that he commanded, a grim-faced Hitler checked in mid-exit by a sudden storm of cheering from the 10,000 army officers which gave itself way to the spontaneous singing of the national anthem, nobody could doubt that Germany's leader cast a spell like few others in the past, and certainly none since. By rare fortune, the three secret speeches of January and February 1939 by which Hitler prepared his officer corps for war have survived. No brief extract can reproduce their flavor. They were of brutal frankness. Hitler set out the blood racial basis of the Nazi Weltanschauung, the economic reasons obliging Germany to push further into Central Europe, and the inevitability of war. In this war, he would expect his officers to serve him unswervingly, to die honorably, and to show true leadership to their men. His contempt for the old Reichswehr spirit was openly expressed, even in the first speech, to 3,600 army lieutenants packed into the mosaic hall of Spears' new chancellery on January 18, 1939, with the three commanders-in-chief and Keitel in attendance. He demanded of them that they cultivate optimism, because pessimism was their worst enemy. It bred defeatism and surrender. Quote, "What belief do I demand for you?" he challenged them. "I demand of you, my young officers, an unconditional belief that one day our Germany, our German Reich, will be the dominant power in Europe, that no other power will be in a position to stop us, let alone break us." End quote. 10 minutes later, he went even further. Quote, "It is my unshakable will that the German Wehrmacht become the most powerful force on earth." End quote. Finally, he told them, quote, "Above all, my officers, you must be capable and inflexible even in adversity. True soldiers are not recognized by their victories, but after their defeats." End quote. His second speech was more of a lecture, delivered to 217 officers, including all of Germany's senior generals and admirals, on January 25th. He held out the British Empire as an example to them, and the human qualities in the British that had won it. Quote, "All of the world's empires have been won by deeds of daring and lost through pacifism. If, in all the centuries of its existence, the British Empire had been governed by the forces and trends that it is now claiming to preserve, the empire would never have been won in the first place." End quote. Hitler held out to his audience the same fixed and final target, the new Reich as it would be someday. His legions would have one advantage over all the preceding German generations of warriors. Quote, "They marched off toward a dreamland, which probably few could visualize and none was ever to see, while we have that target already in sight." End quote. The third speech was one that his chief adjutant, Colonel Schmundt, had urged upon him. Hitler spoke at 6 p.m. on February 10, 1939, to all the army colonels with active commands, behind closed doors at the Kroll Opera House in Berlin. This time, even his staff was astounded by his openness in revealing his future intentions. The Führer described his disappointment at some officers' lack of understanding for his actions in 1938, and he tried to show that Munich was just one of a carefully planned sequence of events. Quote, "Even though 1938 has ended with perhaps the biggest triumph of our recent history, gentlemen, it is of course only one step along a long path that stretches out ahead of us." End quote. Some of his arguments were familiar. The need to prevent future German generations from starving, the fact that no future leader would possess even a semblance of his authority, and that, numerically superior though Germany's opponents might be, they were not racial entities. Their task now, he said, was no less than to repair 3 centuries of decay. Since the Peace of Westphalia, Hitler argued, Germany had declined to political impotence. Now, in 1939, he had brought Germany once more to the very threshold of a new age. Quote, "Take my word for it, gentlemen. My triumphs these last few years have only resulted from grasping sudden opportunities. I have taken it upon myself to solve the German problem." End quote. He continued, quote, "That is the German space problem. Take good note of that. As long as I live, this ideal will govern my every action. Take heed, too. The moment I believe that I can make a killing, I shall always strike immediately, and I shall not hesitate to go to the very brink. I am convinced this problem has to be solved, so or so, and I shall never shrug my shoulders and say, quote, oh dear, I'll leave that for whoever comes after me." End quote. He told these Wehrmacht colonels that he wanted his officers to go into battle with sword and Weltanschauung as once they would have brandished sword and Bible. Quote, So don't be surprised if over the coming years I seize every opportunity to attain these German objectives. And please give me your blindest support. Above all, take it from me that I shall always have scrutinized these matters from every possible angle first, and that once I announce my decision to make this or that course of action, that decision is irrevocable, and I shall force it through whatever the odds against us. End quote. Thus spake Adolf Hitler to his Wehrmacht in February 1939.